Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Alex Ullum, who is the director of the new indie horror film being released in New York and LA this weekend by Neon. It's going to be wide next weekend, nationwide. It'll probably be playing near you if you're listening to this. And I'm really excited to have Alex on today because we'll talk about why here in a second. Alex, thanks for being on.
Yeah, of course, Sonny. Thank you. Great intro for me.
Before we get talking about It Ends, which is this kind of interesting existential horror film about what if the real horror is just keeps going forever. I want to talk about the release of this film, which is a really interesting little sub story here. You know, this is I always joke that this show is about the business part of showbiz, right? Like we're talking about the business stuff here. And the release here has been really interesting because you were your film premieres at South by Southwest, and then it is part of the first wave of Letterboxd video releases, right? And then Neon picks it up, which is an unusual sequence of events. Can you walk us through that whole process?
Yeah, I think the entire process of this film has been very unusual. There was a day where I was like, you know what? I'm uploading this film on YouTube, truthfully. Like, out of South By, you know, this whole generational shift that's happening right now in Hollywood, and, you know, the market was really terrible. Like, there was just, like, no offers coming in on, you know, multi-million dollar, you know, star-led films out of South By at the time. So we were completely dead in the market. We had no famous people and a kind of loose tone that was not... I've always pitched it as, like, if Richard Linklater made a horror movie, and that, you know, wasn't the most appetizing to some of the bigger streamers. So we premiered South By. It's an incredible experience. You know, reviews were good. And then nothing. It was like very disheartening. Me and my, you know, actor and first AC and sound guy all move into a one bedroom apartment and bunker down. And we're like, okay, I guess we'll make another movie. I get representation out of it, and I have a meeting on the Universal lot where they were like, hey, nice movie, kid. Obviously, we're not fucking buying it, but, like, you know, nice movie. And on the way out, I saw they were having the press event for the most recent Jurassic World, and between me and a fence was I saw Nick Curcio and, like, every other movie review influencer that I had followed online. And I call my manager and I'm like, hey, if I, like, hop a fence and get kicked off the Universal lot, is that, like, a career ban? And he's like, whatever the fuck you're about to do, don't tell me what you're about to do. So I kind of like fludge an Instagram follower account, and I go through this fence, and a security comes over to me. I'm like, oh, I'm one of the influencers. And I think because of the general state of, you know, studio online brain rot psychosis, they're like, oh, of course a dumb kid got lost walking around the lot. And so they bring me over. I meet Curcio and all these different people who review movies. I also got a bunch of, like, dinosaur merch, but that's on whatever. I send them all the movie. And then there's just this, well, actually not even send them the movie. They're like, where's It Ends? We heard about it at South By. We were like, where can we see it? And I was like, we have nothing. Like, we're scrambling. So send it to Nick. He makes a video. And then there's just this outpouring of, like, love from the online horror community. Like, I'm incredibly, deeply grateful for that, like, championing online. And then Letterboxd CEO sees those videos, Kit Laser's video. And, you know, Synchronicity just was, like, launching the video store at the time and said, hey, we would love to give you this spot. Which we, you know, that was incredible for us. Like, you know, Letterboxd is kind of our, you know, bread and butter audience, you know? And So we get on there, premiere on there. It gets, you know, the reviews, it gets really, there's a really nice reception there. And the exact same time that that's happening, I'm also taking out my next project, which, you know, those two things together, plus the outpouring of love, mainly the outpouring of love from the certain, like, the micro horror influencers, was the real thing that I think finally tipped the scale towards Neon and being like, you know what, we're going to take a shot on this movie. But yeah, sorry to ramble. That was that's how it went to Letterboxd and now to Neon.
No, this is really interesting to me because, you know, I think a lot of the time grassroots, you know, groundswells can be a little overstated. They can be a little manufactured. But like this is a real moment where if you can get a critical mass of not even critics of just you know, people who like the genre, you can make something happen, which is it. And this is kind of unique to horror. I don't think there's another genre quite like this. Maybe like martial arts action, like maybe kind of, but even there, you know, those movies tend to be a little more expensive, a little harder to just do on the fly. Sure. So this is just a great story.
Thanks. Yeah, it truly was. I mean, every part of this movie is grassroots. Like, it was a group of, like, I was 22 at the time when we first started this process. I'm 28 now, so I can feel my mortality setting in. But yeah, it was a bunch of 22-year-olds that went out and were like, let's try and make this movie together. And, you know, kicked a rock down a hill. And now 6 years later, finally, like, this film is, you know, coming out.
Yeah. Well, so Neon picks it up. This is the middle of December of last year. Obviously it, you know, it takes a little bit of time to get it ready for theatrical, but did you have reshoots? Were there pickups? Like what was the process like of getting it, you know, ready for production or for release, for distribution, once it had been sold? Yeah. Or did it just sit there for 8 months waiting?
I do actually love that there's very specific industry questions. I've been doing some like film school tours, which like I love. I want to just give as much insight into this stuff. I'm probably going to say stuff I'm not. I don't know. Whatever. Fuck it. Originally, you know, we had two rounds of reshoots on the film over the course of that, you know, six vague years that I keep mentioning. Like, we originally shot the film for $30,000, and which we financed through a whole thing, and I can get into it if you want, but like a magician, a YouTuber, and a poker player were essentially our original financing entities. And when I shot the film for the first time, it didn't work. So like I had paced, and I had never paced for longer than 20 minutes, you know. My pretentious young person dialogue was like not as dialed in. It was, you know, just the film didn't work in general. But it had enough there that we were able to like go and finance an extra 15 grand to like plug some holes and fix stuff. And then this is not the question you asked at all. Sorry.
This is great. Actually, keep going, because I'm getting all sorts of follow-up questions here.
Okay. I'm actually going to jump off of that and just specifically answer, like, when we came to Neon, I had already loved the film, so we didn't want to have to change anything besides, you know, like adding the Neon logo, I guess. But they gave us pretty much an option, which was you can either do an early January thing, or January, February, or we can wait to come out after you're done shooting your second film, which I also just wrapped on like 4 days ago.
There were no changes after the upload to Letterboxd. It was like, this is it. It's locked. We're good. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. Actually, there's stuff I'd like to change now, but whatever. My producers would hate to hear that. Sorry.
Maybe we'll come back to that. Let's talk about the actual making of this thing, because again, this is like a real the way you were describing that, it sounds like an Arrested Development episode. You know, I got a magician and a poker player. Like, how did the financing, the initial round of financing for this, come together?
How much time do we have? I want to ramble all of this.
My understanding is we have about 45 minutes. So, you know, you can go as long as you want.
Okay. So 2020, graduated in COVID from film school, went to Florida State, Barry Jenkins. I graduate, I move home with degree in hand. My parents are like, we fucking told you so. Sorry. Can I cut? This is a cussing show. So I keep doing that.
You can cuss. It's fine. Okay. No worries.
I'm getting used to press. Press is also a newer thing. Anyways, I move home. I'm like scrounging the internet for film work. You know, I'm wheeling and dealing actually like $1,000 feature screenplays on Upworks to like random tech guys. I'm very early days on Wall Street Bets. I was like one of the early members. So I was getting paid to make memes on there actually. I would like take it. This is such a roundabout. I wrote some copy for like a pyramid scheme. I genuinely was just trying to like find any sort of tangentially related like writing creative film work. Eventually, my friends and I always knew the independent feature is the future. Like this industry really operates on exploitation, and like a lot of the, at least at a certain scale, once you get to a certain level, it's not, but like a lot of the, you know, lower budget stuff, you know, we really wanted to get all of our friends, protect that environment, and actually make the independent feature. So we budgeted out. We're like, hey, we can shoot this thing for like $20,000 to $30,000 with a alumni package that our school had just started, which is like a free equipment package and a nice like old red Helium. And it was, I mean, it's a, like, you know, a bunch of C-stands and a truck. It's all, it was perfect. Cause you know, anyways, we budgeted out. We're like, okay, how do we get $30,000? Someone, again, synchronicity, someone comments on one of the memes that I made, one of those, like a kind of a YouTube thing or whatever, but, and it's like, I would pay for more of this. And I reply and I'm like, here's my phone number, my email, my social security and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, he ends up being a career magician slash author who like worked on a cruise ship and made a ton of money in 08. And then like essentially just a very rich, well-off guy. He gives us, he's like, here's $10,000, kid, take your shot. At the same time, I also have a YouTuber friend before YouTube was being mined by the studios. And, you know, he was doing really well after that. And he's always been a supportive friend. He gives me $10,000 because, you know, a lot of those YouTubers also want to transition into, you know, narrative feature filmmaking for whatever reason, because they have they make way more people are watching this. It doesn't matter. There's a transition going on. Mm. And then for the last 10, I would I still have not figured out how to say this without making it sound like borderline sociopathic, but I would literally just sit in virtual reality poker lobbies for hours on end and talk to strangers that I knew were, I was living in LA at the time too. I had just moved there, and you know, you're queuing in a lobby of a bunch of entertainment people. Cause, and there's also, again, he would hate to hear this and I apologize, but there's a really good overlap between independent film investors and gambling addicts. But oh my God.
Well, gambling, I mean, look, let's be honest. Putting money into any feature film on any level is an enormous gamble. Like this is just, it is.
So we get our 30. Do you mind if you want me to just keep working you all the way through?
Keep going.
We get our 30. Harsher part of the story, but we also, it's weird because it's very baked in the themes of the film, but we also lost a friend, you know, during COVID. And anyway, his parents started a film fund in his name called Spark the Arts. His name is Evan Sparks, and they gave us an extra five. So our total principal is 35. We cast off of, I just post on Instagram, like, who wants to be in a movie? Bunch of, you know, I also do backstage at the time. I read about like 500 strangers online through Zoom. I find an amazing cast. It's 2022. We finally pull the trigger. We get everybody together. We shoot for like 25 days. And then a lot of the stuff that was outside of the car is just me and two people with a camera. And I don't know, the film just didn't fully, again, like I said it before, like it was a learning process. Like at that point we had just graduated, like you could almost call it like a thesis film in a way. And it just wasn't, it was a very different movie. You know, the film's always been a battle between a hangout movie and a horror movie. Like that's kind of the whole, they're two antithetical genres. And I think that originally there was a lot more hangout, and we kind of discovered that the emotional, physiological reaction to watching that is like, it's good, but it was just a hard balance anyway. So I think I blew my shot. I, you know, friends and I moved, you know, That's when the bunker started. We call it the bunker. That's where we lived, all four of us. Edit the film. I thought it was over. Couldn't look at the footage. Finally edited it. We would start screening to like random people in LA. Like we would just go to bars and bring friend groups back and ruin their fucking weekend with a 2.5 hour cut of our movie. But we could feel what parts weren't working. So I hit up the magician. I'm like, hey, can we screen this to you? And, you know, anyone else, you know, that's rich. He's like, yeah, sure. Come up to San Fran. We drive up there with a sound system, screen in his living room. And then I'm like, okay, $3,000 a share. And we raise another, and then my YouTuber friend also helps when we raise another 15, like I was saying, we go back, we shoot, plug some holes. That version of the film is like functional. Like it's actually functional. That's the other thing is like on these 12 hour days and like on these independent productions, like the BTL really gets, you know, we wanted to protect the crew. And so like every time we'd get up against a 12 hour, we would just be like, fuck it. The whole scene is one setup, cram them all in there and just shoot it. And so like even the visual language wasn't totally functioning either as a need of scope. We didn't have money or time. Like time is kind of the real enemy on that version of production. Otherwise you'd burn your crew out. And yeah, that's why they all came back. Anyways, that version gets to Fantasia. We go up for post financing, which I learn is ungodly expensive. Twice our production budget. Three FSU alumni, Ben Meckler, Chris Amick, and Elio Nostas, all are like, hey, this rocks. Like, if we take this out to our network and get you post-financing, can we have EP credits? And I was like, you have director credits at this point. They take it out. Snoot comes on board, who did, like, The Guest and Blind Spotting, which was awesome because, you know, I loved The Guest when I was in high school and whatever. Yeah. But they're like, hey, are you open to pickups? And I'm like, absolutely. They give us like more than we had ever had at that point, which I think was another 50. So we're at, I think that total was like not 90 at the time, before post. And then I don't know if I'm going to talk about the budget. Like what's the point of hiding that at all? Where was I in the story? I lost my ramble.
90.
We go back, shoot. At that point, you know, I'm 2.5 years older. My voice is way more dialed in. I understand what parts of the film work and don't work. I'm like, I upgrade almost. We know we have just more money. I don't know how to describe it besides more money. Yeah. And I was older. And that version gets into South By. Premiered. That was an amazing moment. We premiere. And then pretty much the second half of the story, which I already told you, where we were dead in the market until we took my next project out and made me, you know, and that loving support from the online community. That's the whole thing, man. That's the entire production story, Sonny.
Well, it's wild. It's funny to hear it kind of all laid out like that, because you don't get that a lot. And I love hearing about it, is because you don't get the, like, we put together a cut and it didn't work. And then we had somebody give us money and that made it a little bit. I want to drill down on what didn't work, because this is always really interesting to me, because I'll explain to folks now. The movie is about four friends in a car. They make a turn down onto a kind of side road that goes on forever. They get out of the car, they get attacked by zombies, let's say, not really zombies, but, you know, they get attacked by people who want to steal their car and drive it away. And they get back in the car and they realize they just have to keep driving. They can stop for 90 seconds or whatever, but they keep going. And that is where the tension in the film comes, is from the need to keep moving. But that's also where the problem of the film is, like, what are you moving toward? It's a metaphor for life. What's interesting is that it's this, as you say, hangout horror. It's this mix of, like, we've got this group of friends. They're in an enclosed space. They're doing things that friends of a certain age do, where they're asking each other idiotic hypothetical questions and kind of debating about them. And they're trying to figure out what they're doing with their life. And they're also being, every once in a while, chased by people who are trying to hurt them or, you know, whatever. it's this... Again, there's this very interesting mix of horror and comedy and something else. I don't know. I don't. Maybe that's the hangout part. But it's you know, it's funny and it's scary. But also there's another part. What was the first? 2.5 hours sounds like a very long time for this movie. What did that first cut look like in terms of that mix?
It was essentially there would be massive swamp, like, so same amount of horror. Imagine, like, you know, 45 minutes of horror and tension and what do we do? And then there was just very long swaths of scenes that I really deeply loved, or like the kids would all be like trying to remember, you know, it's like they would just have like a 5-minute scene where they talked about seeing like the Russian brick video online, or like the, like, some sort of like memory they had about like, wait, like, why did we read, like, why was Moby Dick like required reading? Like, what was the lesson of that? And they're just like breaking down their lives. Like, it was way more, it leaned way more into what just became, I don't know. I always wanted to see like a post game interview for like a Insidious or a fucking Hereditary. I mean, I guess they're all fucking dead in Hereditary, but like, I always wanted to see like a bunch of characters in a horror movie. Like, it ends, and then and then like a bunch of, you know, scenes, not in a therapy room, but just like people being like, "Holy shit, that was crazy when we went through that, and that thing like came out of the wall." Like, I always wanted to see characters decompress about the hideous shit that they're going through in the movie. I don't know why. And I think that it leaned definitely too far into that area of just like, you know, ennui and talking, which I do love. Like, I love that version of the film, but I think it was the horror elements were not fully dialed in either. That was also a newer thing. I mean, the attack sequence always kind of, early on, always was like working, but you know, we were getting, I don't know what, 6-7 setups a day, mm-hmm. you know, like we weren't, there was not time to do, you know, cool camera moves or like, you know, that's why the cast is so incredible too. They were so dialed in that like they could have performed the script like a play. Like, we did kind of like a Following style, like Nolan's Following, where we rehearsed for like 2.5-3 weeks before we shot so that we could just like get in and get a setup. But yeah, I think it was way more of a talky.
Yeah. All right. So, in terms of shooting, I assume you're shooting mostly in from inside the car. Like, how did the actual physical process of shooting work? Because I know, a Jeep is not a big space for a camera crew and rig. How did you make that all work?
I guess we didn't. I mean, we did. Like, it was cramped as hell in there. Another very weird Field of Dreams synchronicity thing that happened is that as we were like going to production, I was, you know, we were prepared to like, hey, fun independent filmmaking tip. Best Buy can be like a rental house if it's under 30 days. But we were prepared to like buy a big TV and put it outside the car window to like project. And our school, Torchlight and Florida State, hit me up and they're like, we're building a volume stage on an abandoned Allman Brothers Band studio space in Tallahassee, Florida. And we're like, and they're like, if you want to test on it and like figure it out, that, and you can shoot on it. It like literally Field of Dreams, like build it and they have come. Like, it,
and, what that's really interesting. Cause I wanted to ask, cause it, I mean, like, obviously in the movie there is like rear projection is what it felt like in certain sequences, but then other times very much not, like, very, it felt very real. I wasn't sure if you were shooting while actually driving. I was impressed for the budget at how it looked.
I would say every single scene inside the car is probably on the stage, and then very few ones are maybe like 3 or 4 are actually on location.
Yeah. I said 2.5 hours for this feels a bit long. It's currently, I think, 90 minutes, 89, 91 minutes, something like that. Which is, you know, it's, I am of the personal belief that many films go on too long. And this is not one that I felt that at all. It felt very, very appropriately paced.
Thank you, Sonny.
Which was nice. Let me you said something kind of in passing a little bit earlier about YouTube filmmaking and studios kind of looking at YouTubers and kind of mining that territory. And people for wanting to make the jump for whatever reason, which is kind of it sounds a little dyspeptic. Like, how do you feel about the difference between making a movie for film audiences versus YouTube audiences versus like what the audience, like what the general sense of those audiences are?
I mean, I'm chronically online. I love YouTube. It's a different, when it comes to specifically breaking into the industry, it's a very different path. It's one I don't understand. Like Kane Parsons is a really good friend of mine, and his path, like him and Curry, you know, like I'm very grateful for this moment that's happening. And I think that like YouTube is not, I mean, I truthfully believe that like, I would love to go and shoot a like DV cam, two actors in one room, hang out, feature film, you know, but there's not institutional financial support for that from any sort of, you know, studio or Hollywood level. Mm-hmm. So I do feel like YouTube, hopefully, you know, with some algorithmic changes, can be like a home for like long form narrative filmmaking. If it, you know, that'd be awesome. I love YouTube. I think the thing with the studios is that they've kind of realized now that like, oh, like, you know, the kids have now inherited the economy. The model that we were using is no longer working. Like we have to, it's almost like, I don't even want to say it out loud, 'cause I don't want to like jinx it. But like the, you know, new Hollywood movement in the '70s, or like there's a whole generation raised on TV. We don't understand them anymore. We need to get the fuck out and let the kids play, you know, like that feels like the moment that's sort of happening right now. And I think YouTube, that's why I get I don't see this film next to Backrooms or Obsession. You know, like Kane and Curry had honed their craft so hard on YouTube for years. Like Curry's first movie, Milk and Cereal, is more akin to kind of what It Ends is, which is this thing that gets scrapped together and like worked on over the course of the years. And like YouTube is a really amazing place to do that and hone your voice. In fact, like I'm like jealous of like people that have, like, I would love to, like, I don't know, stream or something eventually, like have some sort of honest online presence. I'm like figuring out my voice on there still. Mm-hmm. I don't think that this has, I've definitely gotten a roundabout to the original question, but like, no, I have a deep appreciation for YouTube. Also, I wouldn't even be here without the YouTube video I posted at The Magician.
It's so funny to hear you talk about this and this moment that we're in, which is, which is just obviously objectively a real thing. Like this is, yeah. you, I've read a thousand stories about it over the last, you know, 2 months in, I don't know, The Ankler and Puck and, you know, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, everywhere, you know, this is like the YouTube kids, but it's so funny hearing you talk about this in relation to the first experience of trying to get this movie bought and released. I mean, flashback to, you know, the beginning of early 2025 when everyone's like, who are you? Get the fuck out of here. Like it's a sea change in less than a year-ish, mm-hmm. which is wild to live through. Congratulations. You
dude, I got so lucky. Again, fuel of dreams, man. I don't know. It's crazy. I'm just grateful. This is absurd. Like it's absurd anyone's watching this movie at all on a screen that's bigger than their TV. Although, yeah.
Although what?
No, come on, Sonny. I have too many asides at this point. It's like I'm just fucking rambling at this point.
No, this is the best kind of talk. You mentioned feeling different from Barker and Parsons in terms of their films, in terms of Obsession and Backrooms. I will say that like Backrooms and It Ends and Exit 8, that's poster over, like they do feel of a thematic, mm-hmm. Similar space, which is that like, again, what if the horror of existence is that it just kind of goes on forever in your own head?
Yeah.
Which is, which does feel, again, it feels like a very specific, concrete notion that is in the ether right now. And, you know, obviously there's some level of cosmic coincidence. It all comes together right now in the same year. But like, it does feel like a moment and a thing. How do you process through that? What is your thinking of this, this idea?
I think that there's almost, obviously, like, they're scary spaces, but I think there's almost like a comfort right now in liminality, and that my generation, at least, I'm not a spokesperson for my generation, but I do think that like a lot of the tent poles of structure that used to exist for a long time are gone, you know, like the transition, you know, the movement into adulthood, which is kind of what It Ends is about, is like directions to a destination that doesn't exist anymore. You know, it's not the nuclear family. It's not, you know, buying a house or, you know, religion or nationalism or whatever. It's none of these different like tent pole, moral cohesive structures that used to hold everything together. And I think that there's just a general sentiment from people my age and actually, you know, any generation. It's like, okay, something's like wrong. Like the way that like things are going are just like, there's like a, there's something right off. Like I could noclip into a, like maybe the true state of nature is actually like an office boardroom or like, you know, I mean, Infinite Road is different, but you know, I think it's just that feeling of we're, if liminal spaces are transitionary spaces, we're just in an infinite transition until either something really happens, like we're coming up on some sort of large change, or, you know, or it's just like this forever, I guess. There's this general sentiment, you know, when I was coming of age, I was like, I had a rough, you know, transition into adulthood, at least mentally. And I think I felt that like, oh, is this going to be what the rest of adulthood felt like, you know? Anyways, I think that's some of the love for liminal spaces right now. They also just, I could be going way over. They could also just be really fucking cool. And that's another thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of an evergreen concept, right? Like you've got, I know No Exit is a pretty frequent referent point for It Ends, but you know, Exterminating Angel or Last House of Mary Bray, whatever. Like you've got that whole, that's a long time kind of cinematic dramatic idea of being stuck in a place, and what does that mean, and how does that move? You mentioned coming into adulthood at a very strange time. I mean, look, you graduate right before the pandemic. Is that your?
We graduated in March of 2020.
Okay,
March, April, May. Yeah, May, like middle of pretty much right into COVID lockdown.
Right. So you graduate and then everything shuts down. It's over. What was that like? What was that experience like? I had my own experience with it. You know, I had two kids and I'm in a house, and that's different than, you know, than obviously what, you know, you are going through coming out of school, trying to get everything going.
I had, again, like the same kind of message of It Ends, which is that like, I had a really supportive, loving, you know, friend group at the time that like really, we got ourselves through that with routine and stuff. But I can't imagine like being like, you know, about to start high school or, you know, some even young, you know, being in fifth grade or something and having that happen. So like, I still like, you know, boohoo, I couldn't find a job and there was a lot of pressure there, but like, I don't know how it has specifically affected me, I guess, in that way. I mean, it was obviously also, I mean, it was hard, but I hope that when people watch It Ends, they feel like, oh, okay, like, yeah, I do need to kind of hold my loved ones close there. I guess what I don't have full thoughts on how it has psychologically affected me. I guess I until this moment have not fully processed, I guess.
Again, crazy times. Let me, I just real quick, and I don't know if you have any thoughts on this or would prefer not to say, do you have thoughts on the use of AI in film? Because I find that younger filmmakers tend to have much more interesting and nuanced thoughts than, frankly, I do. I'm like a troglodyte. I'm like, no AI, bad AI. But like, I'm curious what you think.
I mean, look, like, it's very obvious that there is like not an acceptance, and I'm not into, you know, taking jobs or, you know, generative AI. I think that, I guess my real, I wonder about what's going to happen when the 10-year-olds or 8-year-olds right now that are watching Instagram Reels AI content and don't give a shit about, like, you know, the morality of AI or any of that, they're going to all come of age, right? Like, they're going to, like, a 5-year-old right now is not going to care at all about, like, the societal impact of AI. You know, they're just going to consume that stuff. I would love if Gen Z was kind of like a final bastion against that, you know, and that's the, you know, you won't get your implant, you know, whatever. I think that my friends and I have a trolley problem right now that we talk about, which is like, you know, okay, so there's not institutional financial support in America for, like, you know, really important drama movies. And like, I have a friend who has like a very deep, heartfelt, you know, about a very important political topic. And there's no financial support for that outside of, you know, unless she, you know, made it, you know, a genre movie. You know, there isn't, I don't know how. And so the trolley problem is, okay, 10 years from now, let's say there's like a magical, you know, generative AI thing. And it's like, okay, I'm a 17-year-old kid. I have a thing that I want to articulate about, like, you know, Moonlight, you know, like, what if there's a kid that could make Moonlight, like a hungry 17-year-old that would use it? I tend to be like, maybe this is just a made up problem. But like, I wonder about once we're, you know, once the, I don't know, I have, honestly, I'm clearly, I'm more against the societal structural impact of like the separation of the, of class that's going to happen from the impact of AI, and how that, like, that's going to be way worse than any sort of thing that happens in a creative market. Mm-hmm. I think that that's the thing I'm way more worried about, is like how quickly the isolation of power is going to like use that thing. Like, it's already happening. Like, creatively, at least, I think that if a large group of people are going to go watch an AI generated, you know, Batman movie, like, what am I going to do? I'm going to tell them no. I don't see its place in any sort of like filmmaking that I'm personally interested in, but like, I see it as also an inevitability of like, yeah. Oh, I guess I'm going to have to release my film next to the, you know, I don't know. I guess that's where those are kind of my thoughts. I don't know. Those are kind of my thoughts. It's like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. I think we're getting to wrap it up here. I always like to close these by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if there's anything you think folks should know, before we go.
I am just very incredibly grateful for anyone who has ever even, you know, interacted with this movie before. You know, like, no one was going to see this movie. And so like, even if you fucking hate it, so valid. Like, I'm just very grateful that like this is gonna be in a movie theater. I don't know, I think that's surreal. And I think that I'm also very excited for my next project. It's very different,
and that is also coming from Neon, right? I believe
they're distributing it.
All right, Alex, thanks for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sonny. I hope I didn't ramble too much.
Perfect amount of rambling. Perfect amount. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark. And we'll be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. See you guys then.